Part 11, Chapter 33, Storm at Camp 3. Harper and Mima shared a tent while Claudia waited for Pablo, Tony, and Dutch in their tents. 2 hours after Harper had reached Camp 3, last member of Mount Everest guides arrived. Actually, Pablo and Jim, along with John Paul, all pulled in together. It had taken them 8 hours and 43 minutes, just under the 9-hour time limit set by John Paul. They looked exhausted. So the arbitrary measure of style was in question. But for now, it was all about recovery. One of the best measures of overall fitness is how fast an athlete recovers after a demanding experience. For climbers, this meant replacing electrolytes lost through sweat and calories lost through their effort. Now they needed to prepare to climb the next day. Michael and Jim started their eating and drinking process, fueled by freeze-dried food warmed with boiled water. "What the hell, I was faster this year," Jim said with pride. Michael politely avoided the fact that he was the last to camp again. Buddies, they were glad to be reunited and also started to eat and drink and refuel. Camp 3 is nestled in a small ice gully. Their tents were part of a tiny enclave along with two other teams. The tents had extra ropes across the top to ensure they would not blow away, a prescient measure. The views from Camp 3 were just stunning. Choyo U was visible standing high above Pomori that would look large from base camp, but now was dwarfed by the 8,000ers. The west shoulder of Everest was visible. They could see parts of the famous West Bridge. As the sun began to set, the cold arrived along with a strong gust of wind. The sound was unique. Harper felt like someone had put her in a car moving at 60 miles an hour with open windows and her head sticking out like a dog. The tents shook. An open flap hit the tent wall with the force of a passing train. Tiny, unique sounds added to the symphony as snow pellets hit the tent. The full-on orchestra came together in total unison, then stopping with the suddenness of an off switch. A storm had arrived. "This might be big," Mingma volunteered. He had just finished melting more snow for their last cup of hot black tea. "Are we in danger? Should we try to go down before the full storm hits?" Harper asked tentatively. "No danger unless our tents get blown off the face," Mingma said with a grin. Harper didn't know if he was kidding or not, but as she heard the tent walls heaving like the side of a galloping horse. "You okay?" Dawa shouted from another tent. He had to scream to be heard over the raging winds. Retreat was no option because the storm continued to intensify. They had no choice but to wait it out and hoping it would be calm in the morning. Knowing that high winds are a part of altitude mountaineering, Harper fell back asleep. Well, for 10 minutes. The volume turned back on now at the highest level as the wind battered them over and over and over again. Harper tossed in her sleeping bag, wondering if this was a passing event or the beginning of an unforecasted storm. Their weather forecast had no mentions of high winds. But as darkness took over the camp, the wind seemed to increase. The schedule became lie down, sit up, kick the tent wall to remove the gathered snow, repeat. High winds, with wind chills that high, it was at least minus 50 Fahrenheit. They were surrounded by crevasses on a steep angle at 23,600 feet. The standard practice of shoveling snow off the tent walls was foolhardy at best. Harper and Mingma routinely pushed the walls from the inside and slept with their eyes open. Harper opened the vestibule door only to get covered in blowing snow. A small dusting immediately covered their sleeping bags inside the tent. A short dream told her sleep had come, but with the suddenness of a muscle cramp, Harper tried to sit up only to hit her head against the tent wall. The snow had accumulated in the walls to create a new hard roof that almost bruised her head as she sat up quickly. She stretched her foot only to discover that the tent width had been reduced by another 2 feet with more accumulating snow as the walls began to collapse. Despite their efforts, they were losing a battle with the storm. Harper listened carefully for the couple in the next tent only a few feet away. A muffled conversation interspersed with an occasional cough told her they were okay. A similar sound came from the other tent with the buddies. Harper and Mingma could only hear one another by talking close to each other's ears. The night continued. It was now 11:47 p.m. It would be a long 7 hours to start till the start of daylight and another hour before they started their scheduled down climb to Camp 2. Sleep was now measured in minutes. A short radio conversation with base camp confirmed that a wind event had hit Camp 2. They didn't need a professional meteorologist to know this. Apparently, it was a micro event, which strikes in narrow altitude bands. They were notoriously hard to predict. It crossed their mind as how long they might spend at the camp. Food, fuel, the condition of the fixed line, wind chill, a million things to consider as yet another gust pummeled the tent. Jim spoke of the storms last year when he turned back at Camp 3. He said the mountains were testing her, tempering her. If steel was being made, it was going to be very strong. The biceps of this iron smith were the size of his thighs as he used a huge iron mallet to hit the tent repeatedly. When would this practitioner tire? Being so high on Lhotse face, the first light from the morning dawn comes later, well after 6. As dawn shone on the tent, they looked around and they could see that snow had gathered halfway to the top of the tent. The side walls were laden with hardened snow. Mi'kmaq radioed base camp as they checked in with the weather, for the weather forecaster. Return as soon as possible was a salient advice. They thought the storm had passed, but they were very cautious. Everyone booted up as the ironsmith continued his work. Each pause in his work only served to raise their expectation, then have another smash of gust coming even stronger. Mima went outside to shovel the snow away from the walls and the door as the winds calmed just for a moment. Dawn began to break. 8 a.m. came as they left the safety of the thin nylon walls. One glance around the camp revealed the carnage to the tents. Feet of snow on top of the tents. The fabric was ripped to shreds. Thankfully, the unoccupied tents were the casualties and not any of the climbers. The massive gust returned as they clipped onto one of the fixed lines that was not buried by the blowing snow. The downclimb began. It was swift. They fought the steady wind with warm layers of benevolent goose down. Passing the lower camps, they witnessed even more destruction as they were less protected than the high camp. Only a few heads poked out as they passed by. The gust often knocked them off of their line, but they were manageable as they began to pick up the pace. They exited the Lhotse face 1 hour after leaving Camp 3. Another hour found them in Camp 2. The return was amazingly swift. They all felt pretty good about that. Over breakfast, they reflected on the experience. Base camp asked them to confirm that there was no frostbite. Actually, they asked him twice, and there was none. Harper looked back up at the face. She could easily trace their steps and see the camp. Harper could still hear the wind. Tempered and tested, they had passed this round. Chapter 34, back to base camp and a narrow escape. The downclimb for Camp 3 to Camp 2 was very fast. They were having breakfast at 9 that morning, and most of the team wanted to return to base camp the same day. "We've got more weather moving in," John Paul announced, "so let's pack up. Going through the icefall in the morning is not ideal, and part of me wants to hold out here at Camp 2, but we also made great time, so let's get going. Let's get going ASAP and get back down to base camp for the safety." They returned to their tents and packed, leaving their sleeping bag and extra pad at Camp 2 for the summit rotation. "How do you feel?" Aaron asked Bart. "Surprisingly well," he responded. "The climb to 3 was tough, but I feel good now. I'll feel even better when we get back down to base camp with all those O's." Over in the other tent, the status was not as good. "I feel like hell," Jim told Michael. "I'd rather stay here for another day." John Paul, walking by about that time, poked his head in the tent. "You can do it. You moved well coming down this morning. I know you're familiar with pushing yourself from last year, but this time it's different. When you get back down to base camp, we'll have over 2 weeks to rest up before heading back for the summit bid. You can go to Namshi if you want. You know, touch grass." John Paul smiled at Jim. He had grown fond of him over the expedition more than the same summit. Jim nodded and continued to pack his personal gear. His personal Sherpa Pimba came over. "Let me take most of your gear so your pack is light," he said, looking at Jim with support, not with pity. "Well, that would help a lot," he replied, handing over most of his gear. Now he only had an extra jacket, gloves, 1 liter of water in his pack. "Give me that water," Pimba said. "I'll be by your side the whole time." Jim just handed him the bottle. Harper was anxious to get down, take a shower, and have a long video call with her family using FaceTime over Everest Link. She felt strong. She felt pleased with her performance and now felt confident that she could do well in the summit bid. This trip to the top of Camp 3 made all the difference in their confidence. "You did well," Claudia told Pablo as she hugged him. "I guess, but getting to 3 was more than I anticipated. I struggled at the end." Harper squeezed him tighter. "But you know, there were time limits and that came back today. That's all that counts." John Paul walked over to Dutch and Tony's tent. "You guys ready?" he asked, not looking in the tent. "Might get a bit windy, so make sure you have your shells." He just walked away now. Neither man spoke while packing. Both had come to understand that they were focused on the summit, not making small talk. Well, at least with each other. Dawa led the team out of C2, once again navigating the multiple shallow crevasses that led to the top of the icefall in those infamous ladders. They clipped to the fixed rope and focused on climbing down each ladder, their crampons sending a reassuring clink with each step. The team had spread out as they'd become accustomed to, but this time the couple and Buddy stayed together. Harper and Mingma walked thoughtfully through the maze of towering ice racks, some as tall as 60 feet. "Avalanche!" Mingma called out. "Off! Noopsie!" Everyone looked to the left to see the falling white snow of ice. It landed harmlessly in a gully between them and the icefall. Oh, that was close. They continued at a brisker pace as it was approaching 11 a.m. and the midday heat would heat up the dangerous racks even more. There was no time for breaks, talking, or anything that would slow down the forward progress. "I'm glad they've only gone through this two more times," Michael told Tony as they walked together. Tony just looked ahead. And then he heard it. The crushing sound of shattering ice. It was close, very close. Harper turned around to see a wall of white powder rushing towards Mingma. "Run!" he called out to her. Harper turned and ran, but looked back to check on her friend. By now, he was right behind her. "Keep going," he shouted. Harper ran as fast as she dared while still being clipped into the rope. The velocity of the snow slowed as the sound returned to a muffled silence. It had taken less than 10 seconds, but it had taken years off her life. "You okay?" Mingma asked his charge. "Yes, just shaken," Harper replied, breathing heavily, her heart now pounding. "That tall ice serac, the one that was 60 feet? "Yeah, we've been watching that one," Mingma said as he keyed the radio to call the other climbing Sherpas. One by one, they all checked in. Everyone was safe. The route, now littered with sofa-sized blocks of ice, was still passable, so all the climbers and climbing Sherpas that day had made their destinations. There were over 300 people throughout the icefall this Friday. Dutch approached them quickly. "Are you safe?" he asked urgently. "Yeah, we're fine. Close call, my friend. A near miss," Harper said softly, looking up at the frozen maze. Mingma took out his mala beads and began praying as they reached the camp in Crampon Point. Harper took off her pack. She sat down to remove her crampons. She desperately needed to call home. Chapter 35, Back in Base Camp and First Summits. "Good news, everyone. The first commercial team summited last night. The storm held off and they threaded the needle. 20 Japanese members with 22 climbing Sherpas," John Paul told the team over breakfast. "Japan has really strong climbers." On the Tibet side of Everest, teams had several rotations to intermediate and advanced base camp and a few to the North Col. The winds had been wicked this whole year, stalling the Tibetan rope fixing team from getting to the summit. They had hoped to get there in a few days. It was strange how Everest could have such different weather on the opposite sides, but it happens frequently. Other news was a speed climber from Ecuador had arrived hoping to set a speed record from base camp to summit. As in many things around mountaineering, there's no clear answer on who has the record. Pimba Dorje Sherpa climbed from base camp to summit in 8 hours and 10 minutes on May 21st, 2004, but he never provided proof, so his record was discounted by many. Lapka Gelu Sherpa had also set a record a year early in 10 hours and 56 minutes and 46 seconds, to be precise. He began his bid at 5 p.m. on May 25th, 2003, and he reached the summit at 3:56:46 a.m. on May 26. He returned to base camp at 11:20 a.m. on the 26th, making his round trip time 18 hours and 20 minutes. The Mount Everest guides team discussed these amazing efforts over a lunch of chicken, salad, vegetables, and of course, soup. "Yeah, fast is nice, but what about age? I thought I might be the oldest when I summit," Jim chimed in. "You're not even close," said Tony. He seemed to have a solid knowledge of Everest history. Now Dutch piped up. "You need to come back in a decade or two, Jim. Yachiro Miro has the age record at 80 years and 244 days. Jim laughed deeply. "John Paul's right. Those Japanese climbers are amazing. Just think, summiting at 80 years old. The first member summits were good news for the Mount Everest guide team. Now that the ropes were to the summit and they spent a night at Camp 3 completing their acclimatization process, all that was left to do was to rest and waiting for that weather window to emerge. They would need a forecast of at least 5 days of low winds, especially when they go to the South Col. The winds needed to be under 30 miles per hour on the summit push that night. Dutch and Tony were pleased that their summits to Camp 3, while Jim and Pablo worried that this might cause John Paul to slow them down and move up their summit and reduce their time to recover. All three had struggled in the last rotation, and they valued every single day in camp to recover. Harper felt strong, thus she was ambivalent about when to go back up. She had grown to trust John Paul's judgment, and any extra time would be put to good use, knowing Mingma, getting to know Mingma even better. She was content to just have a long video call with her family yesterday after they got back from camps 3 and 2. "I was worried," Mark began. "Last time we spoke, you seemed so down, like you had lost your motivation or courage or something. I felt helpless back here with the kids. I didn't know how to help," he said, tearing up. "You did everything perfectly by just listening and for once not trying to solve my problems." They both just laughed, knowing what she just said was true of him. He was always a problem solver. I'm proud of myself with how I performed C3, honey. I was the first of our team to get there. The storm kind of scared me though, but I'm not thinking too much about going back through that ice fall. I don't like that place. A huge towering rock came crashing down just behind Mingma and me. It was too close. Now I know why people climb Everest from the Tibetan side. I'm so happy you only have to go up and down one more time. Her hands began to slightly shake, remembering the moment. "How's Mom? Does she remember that I'm climbing Mount Everest? Does she remember me?" Chapter 36, Summit Fever and Base Camp. The time spent at base camp between the final rotation and the summit bid is probably one of the most testing periods throughout an expedition. "What'd the forecast say?" Dutch asked John Paul. Even though the team had only spent a couple of days at base camp, some were already restless. "Doesn't matter right now because we need at least a week's rest before we even think about going up. We've got plenty of time." Dutch looked unhappy. "Also, we might have a couple of people going down valley for a few days, and I want to give them that option," John Paul added. "I hear several other teams are leaving tomorrow for their push," Dutch pushed back. As more of the members gathered around, John Paul thought this was an excellent opportunity to review the strategy. He began. "First, to state the obvious, when the winds are gusting over 30 miles an hour, the risk of frostbite dramatically increases, even wearing the world's finest down suits. Fingers and toes get numb, you'll struggle to breathe, and even to move. Visibility becomes limited with blowing snow. In other words, it's miserable and it's life-threatening." John Paul wanted to help his members understand the dynamic of the climbers on Everest. There are about 41 teams on Everest this spring, ranging from 2 people to 100. Almost without exception, all depend upon Sherpas to establish the camps, including ferrying food, tents, fuel, and supplemental oxygen. While you may read about someone climbing self-supported, in reality, they all are supported by the icefall doctors who set up the ropes and the ladders in the Khumbu Icefall or to advance base camp on the north. Also, they get support from commercial teams or the Tibetans who set up the safety lines to the summit. If they clip into someone else's rope or step on a ladder, that's considered a supported climb. And some of these, quote, independent climbers depend on Sherpas to establish their camps just like the commercial teams. I don't mean to criticize, but rather to clarify and to frame the environment, John Paul smiling, knowing he had a larger agenda. "Well, maybe I'm slightly criticizing them for their lack of transparency and acknowledging the support they use." The group laughed, except for Tony. John Paul had grown weary over the years of returning home from Everest and reading some adventure magazine about a person who summited Everest, conquered Everest, alone and unsupported. The last time that happened was on August 20th, 1980, by Reinhold Messner, and he was on the Tibetan side. Today, there are many inexperienced people in Everest that slow other climbers, and they often take resources away for rescues. He was done pandering to their misplaced egos. John Paul went on. "As I've said before, there are 3 major milestones before we can even think about going on our summit bid. First, the route has to be fixed to the summit, and that's done. Second, we need to be fully acclimatized and rested. No shortcuts on this one, even though we will be using oxygen. And I'm not ready to say that everyone is ready to go up the push." Once again, he prompted a quick look around the tent. "And third, we need that weather forecast of 4 to 7 days with the winds under 30 miles an hour." The weather forecast was the primary factor that drives the crowds. If there are only a few weather days and everyone elbows to get their spot in line. Normal range is about 6 to 16 days with an average of 11 each spring since 2001. In 2019, the year most talked about for crowds, it went down to 4, and there was unimaginable lines above the south summit. John Paul continued, Best case scenario is to have as many good weather days that spread out the crowds. We have a lot of people on this side this year, and if the window narrows to just a few days, we can expect record deaths, record frostbites, while seeing record summits. That's a harsh scenario. Harper decided to speak up. We talked about all of this last week, and the 19th seemed to be best, but you said you wanted to wait and be one of the last teams going up. Has anything changed? No, not significantly. We have a few members who, in my judgment, need more rest, John Paul said gently. Dutch saw his opportunity. So let's have two waves, the ones that are ready and the ones who need more time. He looked around the tent, hoping for unanimous agreement. Everyone just kept their eyes on John and Paul, or looking at the floor. I'm not going to rule that out, but a lot depends on how crowded the mountain is and how each of you are performing. You're paying me to get you home alive with all your fingers and toes, not to summit. Tony's head pivoted up. He looked at John Paul directly in the eye. He started to talk, but abruptly stopped. John Paul noticed this. Everyone shifted in her chair, feeling the conflict. John Paul decided he had talked enough about strategy for now and shifted the subject. There's a situation developing on the Nepal side. The Everest area has not had the same amount of snow over the preceding winter that it usually has. And even though we're hearing the Tibetan side is getting slammed right now. Anyway, snow is what holds the loose rocks together and prevents them falling down the steep slopes. And as you experienced last week, the route above C2, starting at the Lhotse face, becomes very steep with angles from 20 to 45 degrees. When a rock starts rolling, even a tiny one, it becomes a missile. While we're always going to be wearing our helmet, you can still get hurt or killed depending upon where the rock hits you and how large it is. At this point, there have been numerous reports of Sherpas, no foreigners yet, becoming casualties of rock fall. There are reports of broken arms, head lacerations requiring 10 stitches. This is a dangerous environment that can only be remedied by a heavy snowfall. And even then, it may not be enough to salvage this season if the high winds return this week, like we just experienced at Camp 3. Now everyone felt concerned. Did he just tell us we may end the season without a summit try? Jim whispered to Tony. Now, I'm not saying that we're ready to give up, not by a long shot, but you need to understand that this is a complex environment, and it only takes a few things to go wrong to put us all in danger. And as you know, safety is our top priority. Tony stood up out of his chair, looked at John Paul for a long time, and then walked out the tent.